Hello there and good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show from Westwood One Radio. We're at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Online, you'll find us at jimbotalk.net. You can follow me on Twitter at Jimbo Talks. It is a time for funerals. The funeral for Alton Sterling of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, a man fatally shot by police, will be held on Friday in Baton Rouge. Sterling's family will hold his funeral at the Southern University F.G. Clark Activity Center with the viewing scheduled from 8 a.m. until 10:30 a.m., the service to follow at 11 a.m. And as part of the aftermath of that shooting of a black man by white police officers, there are the funerals for some of those murdered in Dallas, funerals to be held this week for three of the police officers gunned down. Services for Brent Thompson, an officer with the Dallas Area Rapid Transit Authority, will be held 4 p.m. Wednesday at Northside Baptist Church in Corsicana, Texas. Services for Dallas Police Senior Corporal Lauren Ahrens will be held 11 a.m. Wednesday at Prestonwood Baptist Church in the Dallas suburb of Plano. On Thursday, funeral services will be held for Dallas Police Sergeant Michael Smith at noon at the Watermark Church in Dallas. Services for Dallas Police Officers Patrick Samaripa and Michael Kroll are pending. As for the shooter, we have learned some more. Ed Lavandera has the latest on this investigation.
Investigators are still trying to unravel the twisted plot of Micah Johnson and what set him off on this deadly rampage. Dallas police investigators are piecing together more than 170 hours of officers' body cam video, as well as dash cam footage and surveillance camera images, to piece together a timeline of how the deadly attack unfolded. Dallas Police Chief David Brown says investigators are still working to make sure that Johnson did indeed act alone.
We're going to follow every lead till it's exhausted, until I'm satisfied that this was the lone person.
Detectives are analyzing Johnson's arsenal seized on the scene and in his home. Johnson brought two handguns and an assault-style rifle to the attack. Sources say it appears the weapons were legally purchased, some bought online. But there are still questions about what his plans were for the explosives found in his home.
There was a large stockpile. One of the bomb techs called me at home to describe his concern of how large a stockpile of bomb-making materials he had.
And there are still questions about the cryptic writings left at two locations inside the community college building where Johnson was killed, writing the initials RB in his own blood.
I think that this killer obviously had some delusion. There was quite a bit of rambling in the journal that's hard to decipher.
I love my son with all my heart. I hate what he did.
The parents of Micah Johnson have spoken out for the first time in an interview with The Blaze. His mother says Johnson left the military after 6 years, highly disillusioned, calling him a good son.
The ideal that he thought of our government, of what he thought the military represented, it just didn't live up to his expectations.
Over the weekend, protesters took to the streets across the country with more than 300 arrests. In Atlanta, thousands shut down major highways. In St. Paul, Minnesota, police say some protesters threw rocks and Molotov cocktails at officers below them. In Baton Rouge, police in riot gear took on protesters. The images and tension from around the country are on the mind of Dallas Police Chief David Brown.
Don't be a part of the problem. We're hiring. We're hiring. Get off that protest line and put an application in.
Let's talk a bit about this tonight, as we have, of course, spent several evenings talking. We'll spend a lot more, trust me. We're joined tonight by John Lott, founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, and we'll talk a bit about some of what the president has had to say about the shooting, which, of course, John, we knew that certainly this linkage would be made. And I quote from the president, "We also know when people are armed with powerful weapons, unfortunately, it makes attacks like these more deadly and more tragic. In the days ahead, we will have to consider those realities as well." Your take on that aspect of the president's reaction.
Well, I think having guns make it easier to kill people. I don't think there's any doubt about that. but what the president doesn't seem to understand is that here we're dealing with a weapon that wouldn't have been banned by any of the rules that he's put forward. It's not an assault weapon by any of the definitions that have been used up till now. It's essentially what would be classified as a semi-automatic hunting rifle. And, you know, if he wants to go and ban all semi-automatic guns, fine, we can talk about that. I think he'll have a hard time making the case because I think civilians also benefit from having semi-automatic guns. I think if you have two people break into your home or you fire one shot and you miss if there's one person there, you may not want to take the time to manually reload your gun. You may not have that luxury in that case. And so, you know, I think we're in a situation where the president started talking about what laws he wanted to have and figured, well, he'd bring up the assault weapons as he did Friday morning after the attack. And I don't know whether he just can't back away from it or he just thinks that it's not necessary to actually link the proposals that he has other than just to these attacks, other than just claim that they are related.
Well, I would suspect that part of it just boils down to being in full campaign mode and addressing a constituency for which the following equation is quite adequate. Guns used. Guns bad. I mean, I hate to just be too simplistic or even flip about this, but when you get right down to it, stripped of any pretense of nuance or, as you say, understanding of the subject, that's pretty much what we're talking about. Guns used, guns bad. I mean, I don't know how to cut to the core any more than that. And at its heart, that is precisely what we're hearing.
I kind of wish some of the reporters once in a while would ask him, okay, you're proposing this law. Could you explain how it would have affected this case that we're talking about here that's bringing us together, that we want to do something about? Because everybody wants to do something about it. I mean, I go to the barber shop and I have the person saying, well, we got to do something about this. I want to do something about these types of attacks, too. But I'd like the president to be proposing things that are actually related to the attacks that he's using to justify these new laws that he wants to have passed.
Well, let's talk a bit about some kind of prior restraint here. All right. In the case of the Orlando shooter, there were, in retrospect, any number of things about him which might have caused a trigger to be brought about. We can talk about whether any of those would be an acceptable trigger, but at least there were warning signs there. In this particular case, this shooter, as far as we know one thing, that he was different after he came back from his tour in Afghanistan, that he had changed is the view that is put forward by one person who knew him, that his time in Afghanistan apparently did change him somewhat, although exactly how, I guess, would require a deeper inclusion. But, I mean, being in a combat zone changes everybody.
Right.
And as far as we know, I believe that no criminal record. Okay, he had some questionable things on his website, but, I mean, are we going to open up all of our websites before the fact to determine who is worthy of owning a gun? I mean, that's something even George Orwell didn't cook up in 1984 or Animal Farm. So just looking at those two examples, give me your thoughts, if you would, John Lott, about how we would have prevented had we known.
Yeah. You know, the problem that we face is that everything is so clear in hindsight. You know, even when you're talking about issues like mental illness or what have you, you know, little telltale signs, people think, well, you should have been able to read into that. You should have seen something there that would have given you, you know, a prediction about what was going to happen. We have, you know, just giving mental illness as an example. You look at the mass public shootings during the Obama administration, about 60% of these killers were actually seeing mental health care professionals before they engaged in their attacks. A number of these individuals were seeing leaders in their fields, people who were nationally recognized experts on this. Some of them were seeing multiple experts, and yet not one single case Were those experts able to identify any of these individuals as a danger to themselves or a danger to others? You face similar types of problems with the FBI, the Justice Department trying to go and look at the Orlando shooter. Okay, so he had been investigated at one time. They didn't feel that they had enough to be able to do anything with him. They didn't even keep him on something like the no-fly list. It's not even 100% obvious to me whether he was ever on that list. The question is, I think a lot of effort is being put on trying to stop things at the front end. And I think you always ultimately have to deal with the question, well, what if that fails? What if you're not able to go and find somebody who may be crazy in some sense? I mean, in some way, everybody who does these attacks thinks that they're going to commit suicide. I would argue they're not completely all there if somebody really wants to go and commit suicide. There's something off about them to begin with. But I think we need to spend a little bit less time trying to think of, well, if we just put another rule in, we'll stop them. Europe, for example, has an amazing set of rules. If you want to go and get a gun in Germany, it takes at least a year. You have to undergo two psychological screenings. It costs thousands of dollars to go through the process for all the paperwork there. And yet Germany has two of the worst four K-12 school shootings. They have three of the worst six K-12 school shootings in the world. The people got the guns illegally in those cases. France last year had more people killed or injured from mass public shootings than we've had through the entire Obama administration, even including the attacks up through Dallas and Orlando. And yet all the possible regulations, the background checks, the rules that you have there, the psychological screening, were all in place in those areas.
We're going to have to take a quick break here and come back and talk some more. Take a call as well or two at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. John Lott is the founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org. And we're taking a look at the aftermath of Baton Rouge and Falcon, Minnesota, and Dallas, and Bristol, Tennessee, and Baldwin, Missouri, and Valdosta, Georgia, and Lord knows where all else. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show. We're talking with John Lott. He's founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. And after the recent spate of shootings and attacks and the like, President Obama has, of course, weighed in on guns and the need to do something. Although, as John Lott has noted, it was a little vague as to precisely what he had in mind. As we go to a call here, I simply note something that you were saying as we entered the break, and that is, would we really want to be in a situation in which we say to people, you're feeling troubled, you seek professional help? Congratulations, you'll lose your guns. That doesn't sound like much of an incentive to me.
Right. Well, I mean, I think people have recognized in other areas that when there are costs that can be imposed on you, people may be less likely to seek help, mental help, other types of help. And, you don't want to make it too costly or difficult for people to get that because you can have unintended consequences.
Yeah. Let's take a call from Frank in Cumberland, Maryland on the Jimbo Hannon Show with John Lott of crimeresearch.org. Hello, Frank.
Hello. The problem we're facing with the recent killings isn't really a gun problem. It's a problem of racial antagonism between the community and the white policemen who are, in the view of the black community anyway, riding roughshod over their members. Fred Reed is a distinguished police reporter. He's been all over the country reporting on police affairs. And he has a simple solution, but he says it can never be implemented because of political correctness. The solution is to assign black policemen to black neighborhoods. Very simple, but it can't be done because of political correctness.
Well, what about that? Certainly it's simple enough, John, your thoughts about that. I mean, I think that it's quite clear that in more than one instance we have discovered that in a time of racial feelings exacerbated, that we have had police forces that are a lot whiter than the community they serve, whether we go to the automatic regimen mentioned by Frank. What do you think?
Well, I mean, they have been pushes to try to make police departments proportionately similar to the communities that they're policing. And look, there's no doubt in my mind that if people trust the police department, they're more likely to provide information. One of the interesting things to me has been the rate that black victims report crimes to police versus the rate that other races report crimes to police. And in fact, black victims are the most likely to report crimes to police. If you were to think somebody, a victim, thought that the police department was racist against them, that they would just arrest another black simply to arrest somebody, that they wouldn't care about getting the right person that was there, or they wouldn't care about trying to solve the crime at all, or at least not very much, you would think that blacks might be less likely than other groups to go and report crimes. But black victims from 2008 to 2012 were 9 percentage points more likely to report violent crimes than whites, and they were about 15 percentage points more likely to report violent crimes than Asians. They're almost 20 percentage points more than Hispanics, but there's issues there about reasons why some parts of the Hispanic community might be less likely to report crimes if you're dealing with illegals, for example.
Well, to what extent, John, is this merely a reflection of the fact that blacks tend to be the victims of violent crime more than other elements of society?
I'm saying the rate per victim.
Oh, per victim, not per person, right. But per victim. So,
right.
Okay.
And you can break it down different ways. You can break it down by income. You can break it down by where they live. You can break it down by whether the black lives in a community where blacks are more likely victims or where whites are more likely victims. In every way I've been able to think of breaking it down, you always find black victims are more likely per victim to go and report a crime to police than whites are.
Of course, we have a tendency, again, to group people, if you will, to place them in pigeonholes, to stereotype,
right,
if you will. And if you see a certain number of people of any group who are upset, it is very easy to take that image on the news and say, oh, well, all fill-in-the-blank are fill-in-the-blank. It could very well be that any number of members of the African-American community, while aware of things like driving while black and other lines that are crossed, realize that in the unfortunate world in which they find themselves, the police are often their only line of defense. I mean,
right.
Don't you think?
No, I mean, this just says how the victims feel about it.
Yeah,
there can
exactly.
be other people in the community that can have quite different views on it. I suppose the one big disappointment that I have with President Obama, and it's true not just in the gun thing, but it's true also in this race thing, relations, is how quickly he speaks out in such authoritative tones when things happen. So we had the shootings last Wednesday in Louisiana and Minnesota. I still don't know what happened.
Yeah, we've got a break coming up here that I want to have you pursue that thought. It strikes me, I know the president's trying to be kind of the national, scold, I suppose, but sometimes I think he's a bit quick. Thanks for being with us on the Jimbo Hannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, as we look at the aftershocks of all that has occurred in the past few days in terms of confrontations, some of them arising from simple police stops, and others, at least in the case of Dallas and certainly Valdosta, Georgia. There are a few others there that were, of course, deliberate incidents, which in some cases were murders. Nothing more can be said about that as we try to sort out where we stand. And we do so tonight with John Lott, the founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, online at crimeresearch.org, because of some of the president's remarks regarding gun control, even though, as John mentioned, it was hard to square just precisely what the president was saying with his own proposals, which would not have banned the gun being used. We also look at the background of the Dallas shooter, and we find virtually no trigger which could possibly have said, oh, there's a warning sign. So what do you do in a case like that? And as John was speaking just before the break, I would agree that that a hallmark of this presidency has been for the president to jump in, particularly in the areas that are outside of his jurisdiction. If it even remotely resembles race, he jumps in. There was the case, of course, of the Harvard professor who was stopped entering his own house by a Cambridge, Massachusetts police officer, and the professor accused the officer of racist behavior. And almost immediately, the president jumped in and ultimately wound up, of course, having a beer with the professor and the police officer. Well-meaning, I'm sure, but I think, John, you were making a really good point that I'd like you to go ahead and do fully, and that is sometimes it is better to wait until some things are known before you jump in, however well-meaning you may be.
Right. Look, I mean, it's one thing for the president to say that there was a tragedy that occurred. I mean, we all, you know, nobody wants to see anybody killed, even if they're a bad guy. I'd rather not see them being killed. But unfortunately, the president goes beyond that. Last Thursday, literally just several hours before the shooting in Dallas started, the president held a presentation where he was talking about the Louisiana and Minnesota shootings and talking about them being part of the overall racism that exists in law enforcement in the United States. And you know, maybe in the end, it turns out that the Hispanic officer that killed the person in Minnesota had some racial grudge against blacks. I don't know of any evidence yet, but who knows? Maybe something comes up. Maybe the white officers involved in Louisiana were racist in some way. But we don't even know the facts of the cases yet, even a week later. I mean, in the Minnesota case, we have a videotape. But the videotape starts after the shooting occurred, and the first thing on the tape is the police officer saying that he was very upset that the person didn't obey his commands not to hold the gun that was there. And so who knows what happened on it. But there's a big problem with coming out so early on statements, and that is it locks you in. I don't want to make definitive statements on these types of things, simply because anybody who makes statements really early on in these cases, you feel you have to defend. It's just a natural reaction for people to do that. And whether it be the Michael Brown case or the Trayvon Martin case or the Louis Gates case that you just mentioned in Massachusetts, the president, within like a day, or his administration, also afterwards come out with these strong statements about whether racism was involved. And I think it does a couple things. It really divides people, particularly when it turns out that they're not true. If the president were, at least in the Michael Brown case, which you and I have talked about before, in Ferguson, I mean, what else could the police officer have done if you have this 300-pound guy who's like 6'4", charging at you, and you already know that he's stronger than you are? They'd already been in a wrestling match where Michael Brown had reached inside the police officer's vehicle, and they had struggled over his gun, and the gun had gone off inside the vehicle. This officer was much smaller, weighed less. You know, he had real concerns. What would you have advised the police officer to do at that point?
Yeah.
And I just, possibly at least something could be salvaged from this if the president would later on say, you know, I spoke out too early on this. We need to think more about this. But we had 21 police officers injured on Saturday night in Minnesota on this case that we still don't know what happened. One officer has his back broken. He's likely to be paralyzed for the rest of his life. You have several that have severe concussions because of things that were being thrown at them, bricks and other things. You know, it's just, I kind of hope, I mean, these are innocent guys. None of these guys were this police officer that was involved in the incident with the person in Minnesota there, mm-hmm. that was killed. And, you know, it'd be just nice if the president said, let's wait until we know what happened.
Yeah. Don't just sit there. Don't just do something. Sit there. It's sometimes sound advice. To Helene in Inglewood, Florida, on the Jim Bohannon Show. Hello, Helene.
Oh, good evening, gentlemen. You know, this is going on all over the board. And in looking at the gun violence, I listened to three black gentlemen today, one senator, two, you know, discussing the issue of racism, and the head of the Dallas Police Department. And they say, you know, it's good that we're talking about the issue of race. But they also brought up something very interesting, John, and that is that there is a 50% unemployment rate of young black men. There are lots of children that are of single mother households. So do you think this is more of a systemic, or is this a systemic of a social economical problem rather than a race problem?
Right. I mean, you have, for teenage blacks, you have a 54% or whatever unemployment rate. I mean, it's just amazing. And the schools are very bad in urban areas. I mean, I think there's lots of things that we can go and do. And I feel very sorry for people who are growing up without a, I mean, it's hard enough for two parents to raise
right.
children many times. For one parent to do so, it seems like an impossible task. And there's lots of academic research that shows that children raised in single parent families don't perform as well in school. They're more likely to be involved in crime. And but you know, this out of wedlock birth rate in the black community, I don't know what the latest numbers are, but it's probably approaching 80% or so. And so you have a real problem that's there. And I'm at this point, it's maybe very difficult to get the genie back in the bottle, but I think we need to think about this.
We do need to think about it. We'll have to take a break here pretty soon. But one thing that has to be added here, and that is there's no question about the fact that the schools in urban areas don't tend to be as good as the schools in suburban areas. Of course, that's directly tied to our method of financing our secondary education, and that's the property tax. Having said that, every year, millions of people succeed in getting high school diplomas and going on to some form of advanced learning, be it technical schools, four-year colleges, what have you. It can be done. And the problem of that unemployment rate is not just a problem of the schools. In many cases, it is a problem of kids who have not learned about studying. They have not learned. Maybe they're in an environment where even if they know how to study, they can't. Maybe the neighborhood is filled with gunshots and drug dealers, what have you. But it isn't just a problem of the schools, because those same schools, although they need to be better funded, still turn out millions of people who do manage to obtain the tools necessary to get a job. More to come on the Jim Bohannon Show. Back in a moment. Glad to have you with us on the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. How do we come together? Can't we all just get along? Seems to me that question was asked some time ago. Sharon in Crane, Missouri, you're on the Jim Bohannon Show with John Lott. Hello, Sharon.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Mr. Lott.
Well,
I don't mean to get on a rant, but I am tired of hearing excuses made for people. I know a lot of people who, of all different nationalities, who have grown up in bad circumstances, in bad homes, possibly one parent. I myself spent time in foster care, but the people I know, they didn't turn into criminals. They went on to do something with their lives because they knew that there was better to be had. And all that they had to do was work for it. And sometimes they overcame very great odds.
Absolutely.
Now, I know all four of the officers and the police chief in the small town I live in. And every time I see them, I tell them, be careful. Be careful. I have a son in law enforcement in South Texas. I don't like to think about what he faces. There is racial bias in this country, but there is also a bias of color against the color blue. And it is against the police in this country. There are, yes, there are some who should not be police officers who commit acts, and they should be brought to justice because it brings it down on all the rest of them. However, when you have an individual like George Squirrels giving $12 million to Black Lives Matter and fomenting this kind of, I think everyone should be able to demonstrate peacefully, lawfully. That is an American right, and I will stand and defend it to my death. But this is not protesting. This is anarchy and rioting. And this is going out and deliberately wanting to cause harm to the very people that don't run away from danger, don't run away when things are bad. They run towards it because they know that they have got to protect the citizens. That is their job.
It is their job.
And I am really tired of, I'm really tired of this.
Well, you make very good point, Sharon, and I want to have time for Mr. Lott to respond to what you had to say. Excuse me, respond to what you've had to say. First of all, I would note that, yes, certainly many people do succeed in these bad circumstances that often exist in the homes and the schools of urban areas. But there's no doubt about the fact that it's harder to, and that it's easier to trip up in such circumstances. And again, the demonstrations, they've varied. There have been some that fall under the category that Sharon mentioned, John. Others, quite peaceful. As I recall, the Dallas protest was going very peacefully until somebody decided to turn it into a shooting gallery.
Right. Well, I mean, George Soros' money, as I understood, was mainly directed towards the very long-term demonstrations that they had in Ferguson and in the St. Louis area. Mm-hmm. And one could argue that may have made things a lot worse. They surely kept it in the news for a long time. And in the long run, the damage there, frightening businesses away, the people who remain are going to have a much lower standard of living and lower property values and everything else than they would have had otherwise. I suppose, and I agree with you that you can't make on average statements, but you can say, in terms of saying that one individual can't make it out, but it does make it more difficult for people to accomplish things. There's one general comment that I want to make about Obama's, and I think it fits in a little bit here, and that is when Obama sees differences, he assumes that racism exists. So he would, one of his statements that he made last Thursday was that blacks and Hispanics make up about 30% of the population, but they make up 50% of the people who are in prison. That makes as much sense to me as saying that males make up about 49% of the population, but they account for 93% of the people in prison. So it must be that there's some type of gender discrimination that's occurring. You know, people, some groups of people commit crimes at higher rates than others. And we could go, and we've talked some about what might be reasons related to that. But, you know, that's not the officer job of the police officers to be social welfare people. They're, if you want to try to reduce crime, one way to do it is to make it costly and to arrest people when they go and do harm to other citizens. You know, we have police are disproportionately put into high crime areas. Those areas also tend to be areas which are relatively heavily black.
Yeah.
But this notion that somehow we should be in a world where if 30% of a particular group in the population, that should be their share of the prison population. I just don't think that's very realistic, and I think...
No, and it's problematic in the extreme. More to come back in a moment. Back to Jimbo Hannon Show. Our guest, John Lott at crimeresearch.org. And he is, by the way, the author of the upcoming book, The War on Guns. And when will that be out, John?
Be out August 1st.
Very good. The War on Guns. Keep that in mind because it has pretty much come to that. Mark in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Hello.
Good evening, Jimbo, and good evening, Mr. Lott. I've been listening to a lot of talk radio, a lot of the professionals talk in the last few days since all these crises, and I'm beginning to understand the magnitude of the problem, whether it's a mental health issue, a crime issue, like a socioeconomic or race issue. From a gun issue point of view, how effective would an assault weapon ban be, like we had from in the 1994 to 2004? And if something like that were to be implemented, assumably under a Clinton presidency, how would you even get to removing the assault weapons that are already out on the street?
Right. No, I mean, that's a good question. Look, even the Clinton administration paid for research to be done on this, and they were not able – none of the studies that they paid for found – that it had reduced any type of violent crime or mass public shootings or anything else that was there. There were follow-up studies that were done by those same people, and even after the period of time was over, they didn't see any increases. Violent crime, murder, robbery rates have fallen since the ban since the assault weapons ban ended in September 2004. The big problem that you have with this is what weapons are you banning? I mean, in principle, they're banning guns based on how they look rather than how they function. You have three types of guns. You have machine guns, one pull the trigger, lots of bullets come out, semi-automatic, one pull the trigger, one bullet comes out, the gun reloads itself. Again, one pull the trigger, one bullet comes out. And then you have manually loaded guns. The assault weapons ban dealt with some types of semi-automatic guns, but there were hunting rifles or other things that didn't look like military weapons. So the key word was military style. Semi-automatic guns that looked like the types of guns used by the military. But if they're functionally identical, if they fire the same bullets with the same rapidity doing the exact same damage, why would one really expect it to have any effect on crime rates to begin with? And if you want to ban all semi-automatic guns, then let's talk about that. But I think they would have a difficult time making that argument because civilians benefit, as we mentioned early in the program, from having a semi-automatic gun. If you're having to face a criminal, you may not want to take the time to manually reload your gun.
True. On top of which, of course, you have also the simple fact that we are gunned,
right,
gunned in this country. And if you were to tomorrow ban all of these guns and throw out the Second and the Fourth Amendment, send armed troops to knock down every door in the country and look in every attic, every basement, every closet, every garage, if you were to be Hitler-esque draconian, you would still not get every gun. So there are going to be out there, and number two, bad people are going to get them. That's a fact of life, whether you like it or hate it. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. John Lott, he's the author of The War on Guns, published by Regnery out in August. I'm Jim Bohannon on Westwood.